Hey, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast, a podcast that is dedicated towards bridging the divide between the police and the communities that they serve. If you remember, we were doing a midweek kind of check-in. I have not forgotten about those. I think that those are very important, and I really want to get back to doing that. Unfortunately, I've been so busy with so many other little small little projects here and there with my business, trying to get things up and running and doing a lot of other little things. So I have not been able to do that, but I certainly think that that is important. And I certainly think that the topics of mental toughness, mental health, positive self-talk are very, very important to us, to you, to our overall mental health and mental well-being. I want to bridge the divide between the police and the community, but I really believe that the community has to be stronger, tougher, more unified, and a lot of other positive adjectives. That's why I was doing the positive self-talk in the midweek check-ins, because I believe that we really ought to be have the mental toughness to go forward and persevere in these days and in these times. So as I'm studying and reading around the internet and just trying to do some positive self-talk and things like that, I came across an article called 7 Mental Hacks to Become More Confident in Yourself. The author was Lorraine Kwai. She's a former FBI agent. And so I reached out to her, and she was so kind and gracious enough to come onto the podcast. And I really, really appreciate her coming on. In these days and times that we're living in, we're living in the COVID-19. We're dealing with massive layoffs. We're dealing with protests over the killing of so many African Americans. And so Ms. Kwai actually agrees that there is a certain enmity between the Black community and law enforcement. So we need to be tougher about this. And so we're going to talk a little bit about why she wrote the article and everything like that. So really looking forward to this particular interview. So let me just tell you a little bit about Ms. Kwai. Lorray was born and raised on a cattle ranch in Wyoming, where she learned many of the survival skills she would need as an FBI agent. After 20 years as an undercover and counterintelligence agent, Lorray became the spokesperson for the FBI in Northern California for 4 years. Although the job description had changed, she used the same set of communication skills to present both a compelling message and a positive image of the FBI. Lorray completed graduate studies at Arizona State University before joining the FBI. She also completed a graduate studies at San Francisco Theological Seminary. Currently, Ms. Lorraine Kwai is a speaker, author, and a mental toughness coach. So growing up in a cattle ranch and her time in the FBI certainly has prepared her for her life post the FBI, and that mental toughness that I think is so necessary and needed for the community. I'm hoping that you all will get something out of this episode, become more mentally tough in and of ourselves. And so without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, we are going to jump right into the interview with Ms. Lorraine Kwai. Please make sure that you rate, subscribe, and share. Remember, you can support the podcast through PayPal, Cash App, and Venmo, Patreon page, Captain Hunter's Podcast. Also, remember to check out the episodes that are going on Facebook and YouTube, Captain Hunter's Podcast, on all these platforms. So here we go. Here's the interview with Ms. Lorraine Kwai.
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this podcast. I really, really appreciate
it. No, that's fine. Now, are you on the East Coast? Are you getting some bad weather?
Well, I'm in Connecticut. The sun is out. It's a little chilly out. They keep telling it's going to be 50 degrees, but it's like 30-something. So I was actually going to go for a walk, and I went outside. I'm like, oh, man, the weatherman was really off with this one.
So. I come from Wyoming, so I can sympathize.
Yeah. So I was reading a little bit about your bio there. Very interesting, growing up on horses and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
I miss my horses. Absolutely. I miss my animals. It's how I was raised. I think that's one of the things that Vero liked about me. I wasn't pampered. You know what I mean? I didn't grow up rich in some suburb and whatever. They liked that I kind of grew up by the bootstraps, and you know what I mean? I think they kind of like that because they don't get that so often. They get a lot of pampered princesses walking in.
That's what I hear. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never been to Wyoming. I'd like to check out all those kind of Western kind of states, Wyoming, Idaho. Here it's really nice.
Parts of it are, I'd give a skip. I tell you, we're in, up towards Yellowstone and Cody, Du Bois, Jackson, all the western half of the states are beautiful. The same as Montana, Colorado, Wyoming. The western half has got that spine of the Rocky Mountains.
Okay.
So you go east of that, and it's pretty dismal.
Honestly. Okay, okay.
Yeah, it is.
I'll make sure I stay away from the east.
Yeah, do. And but I mean, the western half of all of those states are just beautiful. But then that's where the ski resorts are at.
Right.
But in the winter, you might want to Glacier National Park is in Montana. And of course, you have Yellowstone in Wyoming. And you drop on down into Colorado, and there's some beautiful country there, too. But,
right.
I'll tell you, Arizona. Don't forget northern Arizona. If you're talking about wanting to kind of get a flavor of the Old West, northern Arizona is pretty rich. It's great. It really is, I have to admit.
Okay. I've been to Arizona. I was in, let's see, Glendale and Phoenix, the Phoenix area.
Oh, that's too bad. I apologize.
Yeah. I wanted to, it was like a 4-hour drive, I think, to go to the Grand Canyon. I was like, my kids were with me, and I'm like, you know what? Us sitting in the car for 4 hours is not going to happen.
No. And you're right. And it's beautiful up there, and you've got a lot of beautiful parts of northern Arizona. But yeah, it's probably not the best situation when you've got, I mean, you have to go with the intention of spending some time up there, and
right.
You know, otherwise trying to an add on is always a little questionable.
Right. That's exactly my thought. We were there. I was actually graduating from college. And so I was going to, you know, wake the kids up at like 6-4 hour ride there. I'm thinking we might have to spend a night up there, then 4 hours back. I was like, it's not going to happen. We just decided to do something.
No. Actually, a friend of mine's going in the next few months, and the idea, if you can hike down, it's beautiful. You can hike down, hike back, spend the night up there somewhere close by. That's kind of the way to do it.
Yeah. And when I went to Nevada, to Las Vegas, we did a helicopter tour, flew over Grand Canyon, mm-hmm. and they were telling us, I didn't know people went there and spent the night. I would love to do that. Sounds...
Well, my husband actually camped down there. Hmm. I can't remember. He could have gone the fluffy route and had somebody take his stuff down and back up, because that's the main thing, getting it back out. You could take your stuff down, but man, getting back out. But they have pack mules and stuff that they, you know, that will help carry your stuff up and down if you do decide to camp out. There's quite a few options. We actually stayed in Flagstaff, which is a dump. I mean, by any stretch of the imagination, but it's surrounded by beautiful country, and you've just a couple of hours from the Grand Canyon. You've got Oak Creek Canyon. You're not that far from Sedona. You know what I mean? From there, you can kind of navigate and then change locale as soon as possible.
Yeah. So
anyway, so tell me about your podcast. Tell me about your podcast. Why did you decide to start a podcast?
So I started the podcast because I was listening, and I like a lot of YouTube. I don't really watch very much TV. I watch a lot of YouTube, and I always liked podcasts when I was working out, going for a walk and things like that. So I hear, you know, a lot of foolishness, quite honestly. I guess, you know, people's housewives of this, housewives of that. What's going on, celebrity news. So I'm thinking, you know what, I was ending or nearing my retirement date. So I said to myself, you know, I got something to say. I mean, I think this is fairly important. So let me try to throw my hat in this podcasting ring, you know, since there's like something like 500,000 podcasts or whatever.
Oh, God, I know it.
Yeah. So it's really kicking off, and I guess you can make some money. And to be quite honest with you, I don't want to work for anyone else ever again. So I'd rather work for myself.
I'm with you 100%. Been there, done that.
Right. Yep. So that's why I decided to start this podcast. I mean, I saw, obviously, I am African-American, and I wanted to, and there's this great divide about how police are viewed by the African American community, as well as many other communities.
I know it. As well as many
other communities. So I said, you know what? What can I do in order to fix this? I was one of the, when I left, I was the highest ranking black officer in my department. Our former chief was black. He left before I did. So I was, as a captain, I was the highest ranking black officer. And the next highest was a lieutenant. So, and we, I had a hard time trying to get people to be take the test, be interested in law enforcement. And I know it's due to the lot, to the plethora of viral videos that we're having and just to the perception of law enforcement.
A lot of misperception out there, let me tell you.
Absolutely.
A lot of misperception.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I said, that's why I started. I mean, I just want to kind of help.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. And you know, that's kind of what I do too. I have to honestly say, I don't make a lot of money from it. I'm lucky if I can pay my expenses, but I like what I do. And, okay. And you know what I mean? If it's a good message or a message that, you know, young people particularly, that's kind of like, oh my God, here I am an old fogey. But the point being is that they kind of, people, they see you pull yourself up to the ranks.
Right.
And that doesn't matter what age you are. That is a, that's applicable to any age. And I think that's the thing that people gravitate towards, like, oh yeah, you know what? I was a hillbilly, for lack of a better term, just an uneducated, unsophisticated hillbilly, and you know, worked my way through school, got there. I mean, it's not this. I'm not saying I'm special, but I'm just saying anybody. It can be done. That's all I'm saying is it can be done.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that positive message is what drew me to you and that article that you wrote, and I think it's really, really, was really, really profound, I think. So,
oh, well, thank you very much.
So before we get to it, so I really want to kind of dig into your background a little bit. So just tell the audience a little bit about yourself, and then I want to hear all about the FBI. You know, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I was born and raised on a cattle ranch in a remote part of Wyoming. And, you know, at the time, it seemed like I had all the disadvantages in the world. It was a very isolated environment. I went to a private school, not because we were wealthy, but because we were so isolated. So it was just my brother and I in this little schoolhouse. And I didn't have any of the socialization advantages. And I just felt, and I was pretty much a hillbilly when I finally went to public school, and I felt like one, looked like one, and coming from a cattle ranch in Wyoming, I probably smelled like one too.
Oh,
it was hard. You know what I mean? It was hard to adjust. And, I always felt like I was a diamond in the rough, I guess, in that I had a lot of hard edges and edges that needed to be smoothed out. And I remember when I was growing up, all I wanted to do was get out, is do something different. And I said something better, but I didn't even know what better was. All I knew at that time was that it would be something different, therefore it would be better, right? So thus begins the long process of growing up. So I got out of school. I graduated from the University of Arizona, and I took a job in retail in a kind of a fancy department store because I thought, oh wow, this will be great. I love to shop, and here I am in this department store, and it'll be a marriage made in heaven. Well, it didn't take me long to just figure out it was not for me. I mean, at the end of the day, my big goal was to persuade women to buy polka dot instead of stripes. I mean, that was the sum total of my contribution to society.
And lie to them, right? And tell them I look good in the polka dots rather than stripes, right?
Exactly. And those horizontal stripes look great on that rear end of yours. So at any rate, so I went back to school. I went to graduate school at ASU. And I didn't know what I wanted to do, really. I thought I wanted to travel. And so I said, okay, I'm going to be a foreign service employee and work for the State Department. And I kind of went through all the steps. And then it came the language aptitude test, and I just failed miserably. I was immediately thrown out. And so I was just left totally despondent, not knowing what I was going to do. Anyway, the FBI came on campus. And I'd been through the federal... You know, I knew the federal loops well enough by then. that I knew I had, you know, I could at least apply and I might have a chance. I didn't know. And the odds were really against me. I mean, I think there were like 25 or no, maybe closer to 30,000 applicants for maybe, you know, a couple of hundred positions. But I said, what the heck? I felt like a loser at this point. Everything was just going against me. So I said, why not? And I applied and I did the interview. I went in and, this guy named Denny, I'll never forget him. He was so, he listened to my story growing up on this cattle ranch, and he really liked the fact that I wasn't spoiled. You know, I had grit. I had what it took to kind of work my way over and through my own obstacles without waiting, having wealthy parents to, you know, pave the way for me or somehow buy me into something. Anyway, bottom line is, I got in. I was actually one of the highest rated. I was like number four. And it was so pathetic. I got this letter and it said, you're number four. And I'm going, oh crap, I'm number four from the bottom. And what I called that, she said, no, you're number four from the top. So in a way, I ended up in the academy and it was brutal because I was surrounded by people who had their commitment and their purpose in life and their fitness was way above me. What we're talking about, you know, the first day in the academy, everybody was to stand up and introduce themselves. And so this one guy in front of me stood up and he said he was a former special forces guy who had just come back from Northern Africa working terrorists. And the guy over to my right stood up and said he was a former federal prosecutor that worked to bring down a mob figure in New York. And then this guy over on the left had been a state trooper in New Jersey who survived a gunfight, shootout. And so I stood up and said I was a buyer at a fancy department store in Scottsdale, and everybody just kind of turned to get a look at the fluff ball that had accidentally gotten into the FBI Academy. So I was put off on the wrong foot from the very beginning, and I didn't even know. But so it was 4 months of pure hell. I can't tell you I loved it because I didn't. But in retrospect, I see where I thought I joined a bunch of sadists. Because they enjoyed every day moving into their discomfort zone. I mean, they every day was moving into something they didn't know. It was their discomfort zone. And our instructors, that was at the center of their dry little hearts to move us into our discomfort zones. And if they didn't, they weren't doing their job. So at the time, I didn't quite appreciate that. In retrospect, I understood that that's where my confidence would come from. I mean, you could throw me in the middle of any squad, anywhere, working any case, and I'd land on my feet because I knew what it felt like to be so out of my comfort zone.
Wow. Okay. Wow. Wow. So your time in the FBI, what was your major focus? Tell us about what you did in the FBI.
I initially worked criminal matters, and then I was transferred to Houston. I started working counterintelligence, and I wasn't sure I was going to like that because, you know, the thing about criminal is that you're out there with the drug. Well, we don't really work drugs that much, but terrorists, white collar criminals. I mean, you see the victims. And then you see the perpetrators and then you go after it. I mean, there's a sense of fulfillment. There's a sense of accomplishment. Whereas counterintelligence, it's the long haul because they're stealing, political secrets, military secrets and, economic secrets from big companies. And those are the three areas of emphasis for foreign intelligence officers in this country.
Okay.
And so it was amped up to another level. Suddenly I was with the CEOs and people who ran these companies that had all these clearances or proprietary information and trying to work with them in sorting out. I mean, a lot of people come from foreign countries that are legitimate, but a lot come who are not. And who are given that visa with the understanding that they will report back and that they will provide certain levels of information. And to be truthful, the academics are the worst. I mean, it's like, oh no, that's fine. I mean, we want these people to come. Here we are on these think tanks in this country. And of course, I was in Stanford and Palo Alto and the Bay Area and Silicon Valley. But they didn't fail to understand that political intelligence is huge. It's always been huge. I think the American public is just now beginning to understand how foreign countries manipulate political information, but it's been going on for a long, long time. And so a lot of these think tanks give or have the White House or the administration will give these experts secret clearances to help them form foreign policy. Well, what better way for these foreign countries to understand what's going on in the United States political system than to have somebody just directly bleed that information to them because they fail to understand that there is someone from a foreign country listening to how what they are suggesting that, you know, the policies that the United States follow. So those were the kinds of things that I ended up working, which was, you know, it's a long way from a cattle ranch in Wyoming.
I gotcha. So just as a little segue here, what you worked in counterintelligence and you talked about the manipulation by other governments into the foreign affairs, and especially in voting and things like that. What do you think about what's going on today? And, you know, as I don't know what your political affiliations are, and I'm not really asking you about that, but I want to know what you think about our current president and his denigration of the intelligence communities.
Well, I think a lot of that is naivete on his part. I think it would have helped if he had grown up with a better understanding of how an intelligence services work and how the different government agencies do coordinate on these different different aspects. As far as I, you know, and I'm apolitical, and I have to be honest, I'm so disappointed in the FBI. I am just disgusted by Comey and some of the things that have happened in the FBI, because we are to be apolitical. We are not to say, that person is unfit to be president, therefore I am going to launch an investigation to keep him from or her from becoming president. That is just not cool.
Right.
It's illegal. What we need to do, it didn't work for Nazi Germany to have law enforcement or people in position to make decisions about who was fit and who wasn't. And it won't work here. Let the American people give them the credit to make the decision. If they make the wrong one, there's what we call re-election.
Right.
But the point being is that we cannot work political corruption if we have an attitude on who's right, who's wrong. We let our own political opinions interfere. Of course, we're human beings. We're going to have a political opinion, but it can't leak into our professional job, into how we handle ourselves, how we handle an investigation. That is what has been so distressing for me. I don't care what you think. For political, that's your prerogative, but you don't let that interfere with how you conduct an investigation.
Yeah, well said, well said. So working around all these CEOs and other FBI agents, that really must have built your confidence. So can you talk about that? And you talked about being a cattle rancher, growing up in that way. And then you get to this place, and it was a great story about your time in the FBI, and you get this sense of you don't belong here, right? When everyone else is telling you they're in law enforcement, they're former U.S. Rangers or whatever they were, and you turn around and I sold the polka dots. I really wanted to have you on because I think that really is very telling. I did another episode. I just released yesterday. It talks about the imposter syndrome. And I think that really, really, and I really want to piggyback off that. This episode will be released a little bit later, but it's just going to help to help us to understand, you know, that we can do it. There's things inside of us. So talk about your time of working with CEOs.
My time. being the imposter.
They're going to find me out.
And I kept waiting for that the entire 25 years I was in the Bureau. They're going to find me out one of these days. No, but you're right, Captain. I walked in to that academy with a very low level of confidence, a very low level of self-confidence. Here it was, this venerable organization that had actually liked me. I mean, here I was, I ranked so high, and I'm going, they must have made a mistake. And I'm not saying I didn't have, but I just always knew I was different. And so even coming from this cattle ranch where my best friends were horses and dogs and cattle, to this little town called Wheatland, Wyoming, where, you know, I think there were 70 kids in my graduating class. I was the person who didn't fit in. I mean, I did. I was a hillbilly, and I'm not ashamed of that now. At the time, there is nothing worse when you're 13 years old and you don't fit in any way. You don't sound like them. They do. You can't make the same jokes. You don't have the same frame of reference. You just don't fit in. And so I carried that low self-esteem with me really into college. And then when I got this job in retail, I thought, oh, wow, this is great. And so I kind of started to blossom there. I kind of, you know, I could dress differently and I could kind of put myself together. But it wasn't fulfilling. But that was the thing. I couldn't, there was something eating away at me that just wasn't fulfilling. I knew I had to do more with my life, but I didn't know what. And I'm just one of these people that will just keep scrambling because until I find it. I knew eventually when I found it, I'd know it. So I did have that much confidence in myself and my own ability. But then coming into the academy, oh my God, everyone just looked at me like, how in the hell did she get in here? When I say they looked at me as a fluff ball, they really did. And nothing against them. I mean, I get it. I get that I just didn't, I was not as physically fit. I mean, I could hoist around 50-pound bales of hay without any problem at all. I stacked bales of hay. I carried calf. I threw my saddle on the back of my tall quarter horse. Did all those things, but those things did not prepare me for what was needed in the FBI Academy to get through the physical part, particularly the physical part. And I'd never shot a gun, even though I grew up on a ranch, but I never shot a gun. And of course, the Bureau loved that because there is only one way to shoot a gun, and that is the FBI way. So they could train me. They didn't have to untrain me how the military or a police department trained. I was trained, I was a novice. Same with I was fairly smart. I got through with the law. So there's three major areas of the academy. It's law, it's physical, and it's firearms. So firearms and the legal part, I was fine, but it was the physical fitness part. And that's what everybody sees because nobody sees that you got a 99 or 100 on a test. Mm-hmm. Only the people beside you see that you scored a possible. I mean, it's just the people on either side of you. I mean, seriously. But when it comes to who comes in last, in a 6-mile race, yeah, everybody knows who comes in last or who fails to push out the 50 push-ups that qualifies you for interim fitness test. And I failed it. I failed. And people ask me to this day, what was the biggest failure of your life? And I say, it was at the interim fitness test when push-ups were my weakness. I had a heck of a time with them. And the instructor knew it, and so my coach, and he made sure he was the one to count them. And he just stood there over me, and I got to the ninth push-up, and he just kept counting nine, indicating he wasn't counting it. And so I had to do that ninth push-up probably almost nine times before my nose touched the floor, and he counted it. And all the while I'm going, I'm not going to have enough strength to make it to 50. And I didn't. And I failed that interim fitness test by 1 point. And I almost got washed out. I came so close to being washed out. They put me for a new agent review board to talk about whether or not I was qualified to be an FBI agent, whether I had what it took. But at that point, it was that moment of where that backbone of steel was either going to be there or not. Either this was my future, or I might as well slink back to my retail job in Scottsdale. And it was that kind of, you know, lack of a better word, kind of a come to Jesus moment where I had to like, okay, this is what I really want. This is what I believe in. And this is what I will do to make it happen. And it means I need to kind of change my attitude and my approach. And so from that day up on, I just got up at 6 o'clock. I'd work out. I mean, I was, all I ever thought about were push-ups, and I finally did pass. But that that failure was the most important failure of my life, because it made me bring into focus what was important to me and where I wanted to take my life.
And that is so important as far as really having the internal drive not to give up, you know, as your instructor, who is probably standing over you for intimidation purposes.
Oh, he's hoping I'll give up.
Right, right.
Absolutely. But it wasn't because he was what a sadist. And to this day, I can't stand him. I'm sorry. I was just never able to get over it.
But I realized
it wasn't that wasn't the purpose.
Right.
The purpose was to say, how deep can you go to, in order to pull out what's really important to you, and what will you do in order to get there? That was the purpose.
So once again, it's got to be, it's inside of you, but you have to tap into, and I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, you have to tap into, a person has to tap into, how bad do you want this thing? How bad do you want to achieve that goal? Graduating from college, getting those push-ups in, whatever it is, how bad do you want it?
Well, I agree, Captain, 100%. And one of the, some, a lot of the things I write about now, I've been able to unpack. You know, it's interesting, I'm spending the second half of life unpacking the first half, right? Mm. But I realized that none of us can do that. None of us can really keep going or tap into that inner strength unless we know what brings us value and what brings us meaning. Mm. And so much of what our current culture promotes are band-aids called happiness. Mm. Things that are for now. Oh, this makes me happy. This is what I want to do now. Forget 5 years down the road or even 5 days down the road. It's what's now. And they totally fail to build values on anything more than what is immediate gratification, what is sort of hedonistic at the time. I mean, I'm a big promoter of the Stoics, because they just said that stuff won't last. You've got to be able to understand what's in it for you that will actually take you across the finish line. What is important to you? And for that, you need to do a lot of self-reflection. You've got to figure out what really is important to you. What are the values? Is it going to be family? Is it going to be helping others? It's got to be more than just about you and the next toy that you can buy, because the next toy will be replaced by something else. And so you get, you know, think about this. And I know you have too, but a lot of people get out of college and man, they are blue flamers, man, or they only have to get out of college, wherever they're training, even if it's high school, they think they know what they're going to do. Or maybe it's a trade school, or maybe it's a junior college, whatever it is. They've got a blue flame. They're going to conquer the world. And boy, they are nipping up the heels at those in front of them because, hey, this is a good paying job and I can buy myself whatever. I can get a new house or a new car, whatever. Then midlife comes around about 40-ish. It changes. It's different for a lot of us. But at some point, unless what we're pursuing is important to us, we start to flag. And then you know what? We're looking behind us, and that new generation of blue flamers are nipping at our heels. And that's when we're going, do I have the energy to keep pursuing something that really, is it just about the retirement? Is it just about house payments? And those are important things. Please don't. I mean, I get that. But if it's just about that, we're going to start flagging. And then we get to this point, it's like, it's like that Peggy Lee song. Is this all there is? Is this all it's about?
Right.
Those are the kind of questions that we start to ask ourselves. And so a long answer is I had to tap into something. And for me, it was about looking somebody who's a victim in the eye and saying, I am going to do my best to help you. I will do whatever I can to help you get your money back, to get whatever has been taken from you. And that was, that's what kept me going, actually.
So you do 25 years in the FBI, and now you are a life coach, mental health. What do you call yourself? Counselor? What are you calling yourself?
I primarily, it's a mental toughness. I believe that, and I wrote a book called Secrets of a Strong Mind, and it's being relaunched. It's with my editors right now.
Okay.
Because as over time, I've sort of changed a little of my approach as well. I just believe that being more direct with people rather than PC.
Right.
I'm really tired of the PC stuff.
Right.
I just think people are ready for straight shooters. I don't have much tolerance for the self-help gurus out there who, if you follow my program or you buy this or you buy my book, self-help doesn't work, because unless it encourages you to learn about yourself in the process, because that's what self-help is really about. It's about finding out who you are as a person, and you were never too old for that. So to answer your question, I'm more of an author at this point, and I write about mental toughness, strong mind, grit, what it takes to get through obstacles, when life just doesn't seem to be handing you exactly what you thought it would, taking a more realistic approach and finding ways that you can tap into the significance of your own experiences and your own stories, because that's where the real growth will come from. Nothing I say. All I can do is encourage you. I can share with you how I did it, but you need to find your own way.
That's awesome. I like the way you put that. You have to find your own way. And a lot of times I do think that people can go through, you know, these different 12-step programs, and, you know, it doesn't work, then they want to be all discouraged. But I think it's most apropos that people look inside themselves, really do a self-analysis of their own failings and couple with desires and figure out what it's going to take for them to get.
It's a hard process. It takes work. It's not like we can just read a book and get the answers. And right. That's where I think a lot of people, you know, everything's easy. And if it's hard, oh, you know, try it for something. This is easy. This is easier. And self-awareness is hard, because you do have to kind of come to terms with some of the, we all have weaknesses, and it's stupid to try to pretend we don't.
Right.
But you don't have to dwell on that. The idea is to identify them so you can manage them. And then identify your strengths and grow them. And so often I feel people have this totally backwards. They say, okay, what are my weaknesses? I'm going to work on that. I'm going to work on my weaknesses so they're going to be stronger. But you know what? Your weaknesses are kind of what they are. And what you need to do is manage that. Just manage them. And then focus on who the God-given gifts you have, the strengths that you have. Develop them. Let them carry you through. Always having awareness of what those weaknesses are. The key is, to me, is being aware of when those, whether it be a weakness or whether it be a lack of confidence, or whether it be a triggering and an emotion that's negative and unproductive, being aware of the circumstances that will push that button so you can anticipate it, so you don't let it sabotage you when you least need it or expect it. So you need to have that full awareness. The worst thing that can happen to you or me is that we're in the middle of something and this weakness over, this lack of confidence in ourselves, or this negative emotion, this anger that pops up, and it sabotages where we are in the moment. And we don't need that. And so that's where self-awareness comes in too. It's like, uh-oh, I see this coming up. Manage it.
Excellent.
And keep it from allowing you to be who you're really truly meant to be. Because that's what we're all after, right?
Right. What brought me to how I found out about you is I was kind of searching around the internet, and I came across this article in Success Magazine, and it was 7 Mental Hacks to Be More Confident in Yourself. This was published back in 2016. But I just want to kind of briefly run through these. And I think that they were very apropos, still obviously applicable to 2020 as we're living in right now.
But
the first one is push through self-limiting beliefs. You just touch on that.
Yeah. We all love our parents and our teachers and the adults that we grew up around. We need them. They help us form our personalities and our attitudes about ourselves. But so often, if we're not careful, those same adults are the ones who can place self-limiting beliefs around ourselves about what we can or can't do. And I even as a kid, and you know, I remember my parents telling me, you know, I've never been and this is not important to most of your listeners, but I can't rope. I mean, I'm on a horseback. I can't dally a rope and catch a cab. If it's, you know, I could never do that. But I just told myself I couldn't do it. My dad always told me I couldn't do it because I'd kind of dither around and go, so you're not a roper, you know? And so it was like, okay, I'm not a roper. I will never be a good roper. That was a self-limiting belief imposed upon me by my parents. I had a tough time with math. I'm not like many others. My teacher just said, well, you know what? It's not your strong point. English is good for her. I'm glad she told me that. But she just reinforced that math was not one of my strengths. And it's small things that we tell ourselves and things that we tell people who are younger, or kids particularly. It's like, I got a good grade, and it's like, oh, you're so smart. That's our first response, right? What it really should be is, you got a good grade. You worked hard for that. To encourage people that it's working hard that produces the good grade, not because you're smart, not because it was easy for you, but because you worked hard. It instills this idea that, yeah, okay, I got a good grade because I need to work hard, because I did work hard. And I will continue to get good grades, or whatever it happens to be, because I'll work hard. Those are the kinds of messages that we get labeled with very young, very, very young. And it carries with us, and it just continues. I hit a poor note in singing with next to somebody. It's like, oh God, you can't sing, can you? And I'm going, no, I can't sing. You know what I mean? It's like, but it's one of these things where we create our own self-limiting beliefs about what we can and what we can't do. And that's something I think we all need to be aware of. Of course, I'll never be an opera singer. And I'm not saying everybody can be good at everything. But oftentimes, it's this limit around ourselves that we can do. And we don't push past that. And hey, you push past it and you're never going to be a singer, that's fine. But at least you know. It's not a self-imposed limit.
Right. I want to jump down a couple here. And the next one is, we're not going to go through all 7 of these. The next one is talk to yourself. Something I really believe in highly. Talk to yourself.
So important. I'll just use myself as an example. I negative self-talk, just when something goes bad, I would be accused of child abuse if I talked to myself the way I talked to myself as a kid.
Wow.
I mean, as an adult, talk to me the way I talk to myself. I was stupid. I was ugly. I was unpolished. I didn't sound right. I didn't say the right thing. I mean, seriously, the amount of self-inflicted damage by the way we talk to ourselves is immense. And it's a balance because, I mean, we can pretend that everything is, that we're perfect, and we can take photos of ourselves looking perfect and post it on Instagram or social media, are always, you know, trying to promote ourselves as being the best, the most beautiful, the most handsome, the most talented, you know, it can go on and on and on. But so there's that extreme, But really, all that is just a Band-Aid, because that person is trying to bolster their own self-image, their own self-esteem. You have to prove yourself too hard. The lady does protest too much, so to speak, to quote Shakespeare, in that if you have to try that hard to persuade others that you're that cool, it just means that you have no idea. I mean, you don't believe it yourself. If you keep telling yourself enough, you might believe it. So it has to be a genuine kind of thing where you've got to look at and monitor that and think about what's real and what isn't. And so what if you're not the most attractive guy in the room or woman or whatever? It doesn't matter, really. Look to other things. The way you talk to yourself about who you are as a person, it's so important because... And the thing is, and this is where, and I mentioned it in the article, but, and this is why that becomes important, is because our brain is just hardwired to pick up on the negative, whether it's about ourselves, about our situation, whatever. And negative is, and Rick Hansen has this beautiful way of explaining it. He said negative information is like, it's like Velcro. It just sticks. Positive, it's like Velcro. It's nice. Not Velcro, but Teflon. It's nice, but it slides away easily. It goes away. But that negative stuff sticks with us. And the reason is because negative information gets our brain's attention because it keeps us safe. And our brain is always going to be more alert to the saber-toothed tiger out there than it is to a piece of fluff on the other side. Now, we don't have saber-toothed tigers anymore, but our brain is still alert to the negatives that can hurt us, that can keep us, its job is to keep us from harm. So the negative is always going to stick. And so that's something we have to really counter as we talk to ourselves, as we look at ourselves, as we look at our abilities. It's like, okay, so this is not perfect, but I've got to weigh that with what is good and get those two brains talking together. Because if I tell you something, you try to argue with that emotional brain, the emotional brain is going to win every time.
Every time.
Every time.
I grew up in a church and we would always say amen, you know, as the preacher's preaching and stuff. And we talked about those Instagram filters and polished pictures and stuff. I really believe that the people are really trying to put up this front about themselves instead of working on the inside. Filters and frames and makeup and all this kind of stuff to do to bolster the exterior instead of working on the inside. I think that was really deep, which is. Also, I like the part about what you talked about, the saber-tooth tiger effect. I remember I have a degree in psychology. I remember kind of looking into that phenomenon and how we are, we're geared towards the negative. And it might be something. It might be that saber-tooth tiger in the bushes. And if I don't react in the right way, and I think that that's very apropos of how we continue that today in this modern era in society. We still have evolved to look for and believe the negative. And really so destructive, hinders us from going so much.
Well, it does. And you know, the thing is about that feeling brain is 100% self-protective. And it's just not a good place to be when we need to make decisions as we face adversity. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Because we don't need to flee from every challenge just because it scares us, right? Mm-hmm. But that limbic brain, that feeling brain can't discern between anxiety and a threat to our safety. Right. So, to your point.
Next point I want to talk about is raise your curiosity level.
Curiosity about yourself, about others, is probably one of the greatest traits or behaviors that you could really cultivate. Because if you're not curious about yourself, how do you expect anybody else to be curious about who you are? I mean, nobody should be more curious about you than you.
Right.
And that means understanding who you are, why you do gravitate towards the same negative pattern every time it raises its ugly head. And to do that, you really do often have to go back in history, maybe go all the way back to childhood to see how that's always been reinforced. And often by people who didn't mean you harm, but just really weren't thinking about how they were reinforcing a negative thought pattern about yourself, a self-limiting belief, something you adopted yourself as your, as this is true about me. It's like, really? Well, why don't you go back and unpack that? Is it really true?
Right.
Is it really?
Right.
And so curiosity about yourself is, it's essential for lifelong growth. It's what will make us teachable, and it allows us to grow into the person I really think we all meant to be, the person God created us to be. And so often we're stifled somewhere along the line because we don't want to go there. I don't want to revisit that hurt. I did the Ignatian exercises, 30-day retreat of you came in every day and talked about, and this happens to be a faith tradition. It's not what I recommend for everybody, but for me, it can be adapted to anybody. But you came in and you looked at patterns in your life. And in my case, where was God in those patterns? But you could apply it to a lot of different faith traditions, so it doesn't have to be a Christian perspective. But the point is, we had two people leave because they couldn't go back. They had tough childhoods, but I got news for you. No one escapes from childhood without scars. Some scars are just more visible than others. But I mean, if you want to get into this tear-jerking, we've all had some serious stuff happen in childhood. And it's how we get through it, and it's how we deal with it as adults. They had to leave because they couldn't deal with the stuff that came out in childhood. And there's some horrible things that happen to children. Horrible. And it does scar them. And they do need help in working through that. And that's not to minimize that by any stretch of the imagination. But we all need to do it to some extent. Some perhaps more than others. But yeah, we've got it. I mean, if you fail to be curious about yourself, you've sort of flunked life. And the other thing that will keep you going too is being curious about other people. Being curious about what's around you. I mean, it keeps the mind active. Otherwise, we end up 85 and drooling somewhere.
Oh, God. let's talk about the last one from this point, and there's two other points I want to talk to you about. Face your fears. Last point from this particular article, face your fears.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what the Academy was all about, and that's for self-limiting belief. You can't, this is my own opinion, you really can't move past your self-limiting beliefs unless you're willing to face your fears. Unless you are willing to spend time with it, unless you're willing to move into that discomfort zone, and I think I know a lot about discomfort zones. I haven't even talked to you about having a bull charge me when I was 10 years old. So I learned early.
Oh, God. I mean, how do you have low self-esteem after that?
this is a horned bull that went after me. But anyway, in the middle of a big pasture. But anyway, bottom line is we all have fears. We all have had these experiences. It's kind of called life. It's just life. And to feel sorry for yourself because you've experienced fear or disadvantages is really, you are responsible for placing this self-limiting belief around you. You are responsible. So you are also the one responsible to get you out of it. And you can read a lot of self-help books. There's a lot of people out there willing to take your money. And I'm not saying that there aren't some programs that will help you, but always focus on you. Nobody else can get those answers for you, and we've already addressed that. But you have to face your fears. And usually it's all about your comfort level, where you don't feel in control. Again, that emotional brain, that limbic brain is going to take over. And again, like I said earlier, you're never going to win an argument with that emotional brain, because when you're afraid, it's going to take over. It's mighty. It's that small, mighty, powerful limbic brain that houses our emotions. It's going to take over. So we my recommendation and what's worked for me, and I know so many people that has also worked for you. You have to constantly move into discomfort zones. And I can't tell you that it's pleasant. I've spent so much of my life in a discomfort zone. When I write a book, I'm in, what, are people going to pan it? Are they going to tell me I'm way off base? I just put myself out there, and that's who I am. And so every time I do something like this, I'm moving into a discomfort zone. But we all need to move in discomfort zones. And it's the only way we'll face our fears. It's the only way we'll move past our self-limiting beliefs.
Absolutely. The next article that I wanted to discuss is an article that you wrote fairly recently. It's called Here Is How Smart People Can Stop Sabotaging Their Success. And this is on your website, Ray Kwai. Am I saying that right? Kwai?
You did say that. And most people stumble on that.
Listen, I was panicking about how I was going to say it. LeRayKwai.com. Here is how smart people can stop sabotaging their success. This is on your blog page, and you run through, five more ideas. We don't have to discuss all of them. Take a fresh look at your self-limiting beliefs. Second one is get a real scoop on women's intuition. Leverage soft skills. Let go of the past. And the fifth one is the one I really want to talk about. Scrap the victim mentality.
It's huge today, isn't it? This whole victim mentality. It's very de rigueur. I mean, people, I'm a victim.
Right.
I'm a victim. So therefore I deserve special treatment. I deserve, special compensation. It's become quite, this whole feel good culture. I have a real problem with it, Captain. I have a real problem with feel good culture. Because it doesn't allow us to experience the entire spectrum of emotion. So if you're trying to tamp down something because it's unpleasant for you, you know what you're doing? You're sabotaging yourself.
Powerful words. So there's two more points that I want to talk about. First off is we're going to continue with this victim mentality type of thing. You call yourself a hillbilly. There are many people who are hillbillies. There are rednecks. There are African Americans growing up in the inner cities who don't think that they can make it to a certain place and to a certain level. I told a story on the imposter syndrome podcast or episode that I did. I tell a story about when I was a lieutenant and I was a captain, and I would sit in a room with politicians and other high-ranking officials, and I would kind of go around the room in my mind saying, this person went to private school, this person went to this college, this person went to that college. And at the time, I had not finished my education. So I did that because I wanted to tell myself, even though I don't have the educational level and all this kind of stuff, I'm still in the room with these people. And there's a perspective from the Bible, while I'm not religious anymore, but I do take this perspective from the Bible. And it says that your gift will make room for you. And whatever you
I love that.
Yeah, it's very powerful, and I really retain it. Intrinsic abilities that you have, if you allow them to work for you, you'll be in the presence of other people who are great or who are good at what they do. So I want you to, if you can, talk to those hillbillies out there, talk to those rednecks, talk to those inner... No, seriously, because I grew up in the inner city, limited access to resources, but I end up making it to captain. I probably could have gone farther if I would have stayed, but talk to the rednecks, talk to the hillbillies, talk to the inner city black kids, talk to the inner city Puerto Rican kids, tell them about how they can make it if they just give it a chance.
That's so well said. You really, really touched my heart the way you expressed that. And I really do believe that we attract people who share our beliefs and our attitudes. And if we surround ourselves with negative people, guess what? That's just going to rub off on us. I wrote an article called Why You Need to Dump Your Loser Friends.
Wow.
And it's an important, I thought, felt, and still do, it's an important point because it really does make a difference in who you surround yourself with. And growing up, I didn't have anybody to surround myself with besides my horses and my dogs and my cows. But when I was in high, when I finally did reach civilization, it became very hard for me to be honest, it was hard for me to attract the winners because I was looked at as a loser. And now I can say that. At the time, it hurt so bad. The scar was so deep. And I just walked around with this sense of hopelessness. I can't really phrase it much differently because I was kind of classified as a loser, and the only kids that would hang out with me were the other losers. So it was just a decision I had to make myself. And, you know, this would have been in my mid-teens, maybe about 14. I looked at the people who were around me, and I just thought, I don't want to be like them. I just don't want to be like them. So what it meant was I not only didn't have the winners in my school as friends, I didn't even have the losers because I dropped them. Right. I dropped them.
Right.
But when they started dropping, and I was alone. I mean, that's just, I had to go it alone, but I'd kind of been there before. So I just kind of figured I'd figure my way out. And, I did. I was never popular. Please don't ever assume that. But I just knew that I had to focus what was right for me. And I had to focus. And for me at that point in time, it was education. I knew I would never get out of this this hole, for lack of a better word, unless I was educated, and I knew that would open a door for me, or at least I hoped it did, or felt it would. And so that was that. And so when I made that choice, and it was come hell or high water, because I worked my way through school, I didn't have rich parents. I got a few scholarships, not enough to get me through, but I got some. I just worked two jobs and made enough to get through school. But my point here is that it's so easy, I think, to, and again, it goes back to the victim thing. I can look at myself as a victim. I can't control. So this is my thinking. If I can't control my external circumstances, I'd better learn how to control my response to them.
Mm.
Right? Because once I let go, the expectation that things are going to be hunky-dory, that things are, you know, I'm going to get this high-paying job, suddenly I'm going to be popular, you've got to be kidding, that was a fantasy. Whatever. I mean, as soon as I let that go, the only opinion that really mattered was I had to accept reality. And so I went to school, and I just had to accept where I was. And then look to where I wanted to be, and then plot my own way from point A to point B. And some of the issues I have today on college campuses in particular, and I'm on the, I'm very close to UC Berkeley over here in Berkeley, is that this whole idea of safe places.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I have a real problem with that. Yeah. Because a safe place, and I've seen it in action over at Berkeley. I've seen it, and I've seen it take down leaders over there. I've seen it take it down. A small group of people say, you know what? It's almost like bigotry, almost. If you don't believe like I do, you don't deserve to exist. It's cancel culture. But the thing is, with a safe place, it discourages the intellectual confrontations, and it breeds a culture where assumptions go unchallenged because emotions must be protected at all costs.
Right.
And microaggressions, that's huge now. Microaggressions are policed because they might wound somebody, or they might create hard feelings or create a place or an environment where they don't feel particularly safe. And all that does is just teach people to ignore conflict and to suppress negative emotions because they might be ugly, they might be hurtful. But you know what? Those emotions are part of this broad spectrum that we are going to experience in life. And to pretend that we won't is stupid. It's just stupid. And so I just say, you know what? We need the courage to create brave spaces, not safe places, but brave places where we can explore differences without fear of being retaliated. It's a place where people feel safe enough to explore their differences. And that takes courage.
I agree.
It takes courage. And so we need to help each other be stronger, not weaker and timid in the way we live our life.
I completely agree. Last point, and then I will let you go, is I would be remiss if I didn't get one of your favorite stories from the FBI, favorite case, favorite story. Lay it on us.
Oh, God, there are so many. I could go back to the Academy, but I think I've spent a little time at the Academy, and you probably want to move on from that.
Yeah. After the Academy.
Yeah, after the Academy, because that's just a gold mine of wonderful stories. So I will talk. How about if I share with you my first arrest?
Okay. Yeah.
Because at the Academy, and I bet you can share this as well with your training experiences, everything is controlled. I mean, you know, you do all these false arrests at the Academy in Hogan's Alley, and you pull people. So the way we're trained to do it is that you walk up with your gun drawn, you open, yank open the door, you pull out the suspect, you throw him on the ground, and you slap handcuffs on him, right? That's how we're trained to do it. Okay, so fast forward to real life. And I am in Phoenix, actually. It's my first office, and it's my first arrest. And actually, it wasn't supposed to be my arrest. It was a man who wanted for extortion. And I was just with my case agent, who was my training agent. And he said, okay, we're going to have a SWAT team, the FBI SWAT team, take this guy down because we believe he's armed and dangerous. And so we met early that morning, and the SWAT team was on board, and we had surveillance, and I was just to go along as an observer to watch how it should be done by the big guys, right? And so we're on a busy road, and the plan was for FBI SWAT to surround the car. He gets to his first, and we didn't want to arrest him at the house because we didn't know who was in the house. We did know armed and dangerous. We just didn't want to take a chance of gunfire there. So we thought we'd isolate him and get him alone. So the plan was to arrest him when he comes to either for stop sign or stop light. Okay.
And he was wondering for embezzlement? That what you said?
No, extortion.
Extortion.
And he was known to be armed and dangerous.
Armed and dangerous.
Okay. It was a tough guy, right?
Okay.
So
a mafia guy? Extortion, armed and dangerous? Was he?
No, he wasn't. He wasn't affiliated with the mafia, but he was just with a gang.
Okay.
I can't even remember what the extortion was. It was kidnapping. I know there was a kidnapping charge against him, extortion. There were just a whole host of things against him, and he'd crossed state lines, which is what made him a federal a fugitive, right?
Okay.
So he just gets right on the freeway, or right onto this busy road, right? And no stop sign. And he hits every green light. Heavy traffic, morning, you know, commute. Every light is green. One by one, the SWAT team gets cut off. Their cars are, I'm looking in the rearview mirror, and I'm looking for him going, Ron, they're not there. And Ron's like, he'd run over an old lady to keep up next to this guy because we needed to get him. He'd been on the run for a while. So Ron kept up with the car. I mean, he cut off cars, whatever. He stayed right with him. And we got to the first red light. And Ron pulled up right. He pulled up right beside him. I'm in the shotgun seat, right? And Ron looks over at me, and he says, you're it. We've got to arrest him. Who knows? He could get away from us. I'm going, holy crap. I'm making the arrest, my first arrest. Armed and dangerous, fugitive, extortion, whatever. So I'm thinking, oh, what am I going to do here? So I had a raid jacket on. I took that off. And I was literally right beside him. I could look, he was like 4 feet from me because I was looking right at his profile. So I had a sweater on. I pulled it over my gun and I opened the door. And I thought, you know, this, I've got to go with I've got to go with what's in front of me. I got to work with what I've got, right? So I don't look like an FBI agent. I'm kind of blonde and I just don't look like an FBI agent. So I tapped on his window. And he looked at me and I kind of waved and smiled and he kind of waved back and smiled. And then I motioned for him to, roll down his window, which he did do. And he said, can I help you? And I said, yes. And I pulled my gun. I said, FBI, you're under arrest. And he was so shocked. we were the first at the light and he had a clutch. Car, you know, stick shift, and his foot slipped off the clutch and he jerked into the intersection. And I stayed right with him though. You know what I mean? I'm up there, I'm holding a gun. And by this time, I could hear the guys coming up. They knew what was going on and they were wearing flak jackets because it's kind of disconcerting to have a gun pulled on somebody in the intersection and, you know, there's no ID, right? So they came up with their FBI raid jackets. And so people kind of knew that this wasn't a holdup or something. But he was a big guy. I mean, he was huge and he was, I mean, his driver's wheel was up against his chest. I mean, he was just a huge guy. And I'm going, holy crap, there is no way I am going to be able to pull him from the car, throw him on the ground, and slap handcuffs on him like we were trained to do, right? And so I just said, keep your hands up, keep them up. And I was prepared to shoot if I had to, because we did have information that he was armed and dangerous. We had made a furtive move, but he didn't. And he just sat there. I mean, I just think, so it was the element of surprise, but it kind of worked with what I had, right? I wasn't a big burly guy who was somehow intimidating to him. I had the gun. That was intimidating enough. But so he stayed where he was. And then sure enough, the FBI SWAT guys came up. They did everything we were trained to do and threw handcuffs on him. And there was a gun under his front seat. So it was kind of one of those things where, you know, plans don't always go according to the way you hope they would. But that just speaks to the ability to be flexible, to adapt to circumstances, not stick to a plan if it doesn't work, and to always be curious about your other options and how you can still come out, how you can move into the unknown and still land on your feet. And that's the thing for all of us, right?
Right. Absolutely. Thank you for that story. Great story. Great story. So tell us about what you have coming up next, how we can contact you, how we can get a hold of your book whenever that comes out. You got two books, right? So tell us about what got going on.
I'm in the process of relaunching my first book, which is called Secrets of a Strong Mind. And it does follow a lot of the childhood experiences I had. Right up through the FBI and what worked, what didn't work, and how people can hopefully my books, and I have two of them, will always encourage people to excavate the significance of their own stories and their own experiences, because the true teacher will be ourselves. And I can sort of offer a little guidance, other people can, but it'll always be up to the person reading or the person doing the work to actually come up with the real product, and which is going to be that authentic person that's truly following a life that gives them value and meaning. The second book is called Mental Toughness for Women Leaders. And I think women is mentioned once in the book. So it's really mental toughness for people. My publisher thought it would give women leaders permission to read a leadership book because it was written by a woman, but in truth, it's for anybody really. And I marry a lot of neuroscience with a psychology and just practical experience in the second book. I would love to connect with all of your listeners. And it's very easy because my name is so unusual. It's Larae Quay, L-A, capital R-A-E, Quay, and you can go to any social media, and I'm just there, just Larae Quay at Twitter, Larae Quay at Facebook, on Facebook, or Larae Quay on LinkedIn. So, and my blog is larayquay.com. So I would love to hear from everyone. And I have a free mental toughness assessment on my website that might help people kind of figure out where in their life they might need to work on. And again, it's going to require work on their part. And there's no easy answers.
I certainly appreciate coming to Captain Hunter's podcast. Thank you so much for your stories, for your time. Thank you for the mental toughness. I really, really enjoyed that article, which I reached out.
I'm so glad.
I think it's extremely, extremely important. I think that people suffer lack of self-esteem. They don't have the mental toughness to do X, whatever. Back to school. Learn a new hobby, learn how to play the piano, take swimming lessons, whatever it is. They don't have much toughness to do it. And I appreciate people who are trying to do it. And I appreciate your time in law enforcement.
Thank you. And same, and vice versa, for your time as well. It's an honorable profession.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. So I'd like to have you on again. Maybe we can talk about some FBI stuff or whatever going on.
Sure. Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, thank you so much, so much for.
I enjoyed it a lot. I appreciate what you're trying to do as well.
It's an uphill battle. Believe me, it's an uphill battle.
Yes, it is. I understand that, and I totally understand that, and I agree with you. Unfortunately, yeah. Which is sad.